about, you know, I wouldn't define myself as an activist, but at the end of the day, it's the right thing to do. And I want to see the normalization of cannabis. And that was one of the things that really pushed us to go public and talking about our farm and allowing media to come to the farm and videotaping it and putting it out into the world, was that without normalization, we're not going to see sensible policy. And so to really try to put a face, a set of faces, a family to cannabis cultivation and say, this is small farming. This is something that we need in the agricultural toolbox for farmers. And if we're not going to be able to deal with it with sensible policy, then it's not going to work. And so, you know, on the one hand, yeah, when they announced Sessions was the AG, it was a moment for fear and a time to step back and think about it. But it was also a time to set resolution and to continue forward in the journey.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us, Casey. We wish you the best of luck. And please keep us posted.
Yes, sir. Much love. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PugsFest, Saturday, April 22nd at Tabor Space in Portland. PugsFest is a celebration of lifelong learning with a whole day dedicated to sharing ideas and questions through original workshops. This year, our central theme is space and spaces. Spaces in between, spaces outside, spaces of resistance. Workshops include Truth in the Social, The Echo Chamber and Wild Spaces, The Approachability of Outer Space, and much more. Again, that's PugsFest, Saturday, April 22nd at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 6th Annual Inner City Blues Festival, Saturday, April 22nd at Eagles Lodge in Portland. Healing the Healthcare Blues supports healthcare for all Oregon, working to bring an equitable, publicly funded healthcare systems to all Oregonians. The festival features the Norman Sylvester Band, the Oboe Addy Legacy Project, Mary Flower, Shoehorn, and many more performance and speakers. KBOO will be broadcasting this festival from 6 p.m. to midnight. Again, that's the 6th Annual Inner City Blues Festival, Saturday, April 22nd at Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter Avenue and Lombard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's a little after 11 a.m. Coming up on the radio zine, we have a live interview with ex-CIA operative John Kiriakou, sent to federal prison for blowing the cover off the torture scandal at Guantanamo Bay. And 11:30, Making Contact presents Spies of Mississippi, the true story of a secret spy agency formed by the state of Mississippi to preserve segregation and maintain white supremacy. Yes, this is what your community can accomplish with you and your friends and neighbors all joining together to make it happen. Some of y'all do your part by kicking in the funds to pay all the bills that your friends and neighbors incur in making radio. If you're not one of those yet, you can take care of that lack, that deficit at kboo.fm/GIVE. Stay tuned.
Contact. You'll hear excerpts from the documentary Spies of Mississippi, the real story of government spying on activists during the civil rights era.
Within 3 to 4 years of its being formed, the Mississippi State Sovereign Commission transforms itself into a full-blown spy agency with a whole network of investigators and agents to go around the state exploring things that were going to possibly change what people euphemistically called the Mississippi way of life.
Imagine being black in the 50s. You return home from defending your country to segregated Mississippi, where you are denied admissions to Mississippi Southern College because of the color of your skin. You publish a letter protesting the racist laws of your state, only to be put under surveillance by a state commission that slaps false charges against you and gets you in prison until your last days. That's the story of civil rights activist Clyde Kinnard, who was released just before his death in 1963. He wouldn't be pardoned until 50 years later. The Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission, or SUVCOM, performed this type of state-sanctioned persecution and murder. Although this took place more than 50 years ago, one can draw parallels to the several executive orders and policies that target vulnerable communities today: Muslims, undocumented immigrants, African Americans, and LGBTQ people. Spies of Mississippi, a documentary directed and produced by Don Porter and executive produced by Lux TV and Martina Hallbridge, takes a close look at the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission, an agency established shortly after the Brown v. Board of Education decision, to ensure that the state would remain segregated. SUVCOM coordinated its activities with members of the Ku Klux Klan, a domestic terrorist organization that illegally surveilled the activities of civil rights workers and prevented attempts to desegregate the state and register blacks to vote.
The political atmosphere in Mississippi in the middle 1950s was beginning to change very drastically.
By 1956, Brown versus Board of Education had been passed. The great Supreme Court ruling that said that you couldn't discriminate within education on the basis of race. The legislature of Mississippi was almost 100% segregationist. And many of them rabid segregationists at the time who felt that the struggle was starting to turn against the state, and that the federal government was gaining power to enforce civil rights laws, and they create a special agency with the direct mission to preserve segregation.
In the legislature of 1956, one of the major bills that was passed during that session was a bill to create something called the Sovereignty Commission.
I'm sure that you will not fail to enact an appropriate state sovereignty bill, which will enable us during the next 2 years to maintain a successful fight for preserving the separation of the races in this state.
At that time, it seemed to be a harmless kind of legislation. It was more like a white chamber of commerce. Then we began to ask questions about it, about how that bill could be abused.
Hey, morning once again. My guest is John Kiriakou. He, as many listeners know, but just to get everybody up to speed, John has just come out with a new book, is doing time like a spy. And if you think that is any way suggestive of the fact that it's easier to do time if you're a spy, well, I'm guessing the answer is yes and no. But we're going to be asking John that in just a moment. John Kiriakou was a CIA analyst and case officer, senior investigator for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, counterterrorism consultant for ABC News, and an author. He was the first U.S. government official to confirm in December of 2007 that waterboarding was used to interrogate al-Qaeda prisoners, which he described as torture. Kiriakou pleaded guilty to disclosing the identity of a fellow CIA officer. He was the first CIA officer to be convicted for passing classified information to a reporter. Well, that's, of course, questionable, although the reporter did not publish the name of the operative. John Kiriakou was sentenced to 30 months in prison and served his term from February 28, 2013 until February 3, 2015 at the Federal Correctional Facility near Loretto, Pennsylvania. And that brings us up to speed to the current day. A book is coming out, as you said before, Doing Time Like a Spy. And John, thank you so much. I'm so pleased to have you on the line speaking with you once again. The last time we spoke, I believe, was on Air Cascadia, and this was before you went to prison.
It was. It's been several years. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Well, thank you so much. We will actually be taking calls if it's possible. I'm not sure how, if we will. Callers are welcome to call in if you've got a question, but I'm pretty sure this is going to be mesmerizing enough. The number to call, nonetheless, of course, is 503-231-8187. Again, that is 503-231-8187. Just to keep the history straight here, we are speaking the morning after the United States murdered a man. That's right, they murdered him, and we are still coming to terms with that. As we said at Cascadia, he's gone now. He's in the rearview mirror, a tiny black star forever receding. He'll always be there. He'll be always be that little grain of sand in our eyes that is a reminder of what we did. That said, prison is another form of death. I try to make myself imagine it. Reading the book, normally I read a book in about 2 days. This book, it took me weeks, and I'm still going back and finishing it. The structure of the book is quite unique and well-suited for its task. I read it and I thought this is like a play. This is theater in a tiny box, in a tiny cage, where drama of human emotions overflows the walls. Well, when you first went in, you were not expecting to be in the type of facility that you found yourself in. You were ready to go to one place, and they led you around to different. What happened there?
Well, in my sentencing hearing, my attorneys asked the judge to send me to a minimum security work camp. A work camp is, well, it's kind of hard to describe. It's almost as though you're not in prison. There are no bars on the windows. There are no walls. The doors are not locked. You can work in town, and you're on your honor to come back at night and not abscond. And there's usually a work camp across the street from a higher security prison, because in the event of a riot or a lockdown, it's the people in the camp who make the prison run. They do the laundry, they cook the food, they do the day-to-day work. So my attorneys asked that I be sent to a minimum security camp. The prosecutors had no objection, and the judge agreed, and she so ordered. So on February 28, 2013, I drove up to the Federal Correctional Institution at Loretto, Pennsylvania, FCI Loretto, and turned myself in. And what you do is you literally just knock on the door and say, "Hi, I'm John Kiriakou. I'm here to turn myself in." So one of my attorneys had driven me up, Jesslyn Radak, who's a whistleblower in her own right. Tom Drake, the NSA whistleblower, was with me. A documentary filmmaker was there. My cousin and his son-in-law came. And we said our goodbyes, and they drove off. So the correctional officer began leading me outside, and instead of going across the street to the camp, he began leading me around to the back of the actual prison. I said, "No, no, I'm supposed to be at the camp across the street." And he chortled and said, "Ha, not according to my paperwork, you're not." Well, I told myself, take it easy, calm down, there's nothing you can do. Don't make a scene because you'll end up in solitary. So I remained as calm as I possibly could. I was processed into the prison. It was 5 days before I finally got access to a telephone. And I called one of my attorneys and I said, "Listen, they put me in the actual prison with the murderers and the pedophiles and the drug kingpins. What do I do?" And he said, "Oh my gosh, well, we can file a motion with the court, but it'll be 2 years before we get a hearing, and you'll be home by then." He said, "I'm sorry, you're just going to have to tough it out."
Or dead, home or dead. I mean, if you're in that type of, that's a very far cry from what you had been led to expect, and the impossibility. Once, I think that just to draw a line under that for listeners, I don't know how to say how it must be so. It's extraordinary the power once you're inside, and they do whatever they want with you.
Whatever they want, and you have no recourse, none whatsoever.
That's the terror there, and the humiliation of it being booked to prison in any case, the first step when it's stripped of all dignity and then left in that state, that's to reconstruct one's own, it's like putting your own face back together. Can you talk a little bit about some of the people that you met inside, that sort of the characters that most stand out in your mind?
There really were extremes among the people that I became acquainted with. My bunkmate was the Auditor General of Cuyahoga County, Ohio. He was a candidate for governor at the time of his arrest, a natural-born politician and a wonderful human being who was caught up in a political corruption case. He refused to testify against his co-defendants, and so he was given 27 years in prison. This is a guy who's 70 years old, who's had multiple heart attacks. He knows that this was a death sentence, and he didn't belong in prison. There were a lot of people that I met that I really believed just didn't belong in prison. People who may have made a mistake, may have done something stupid, but you get a prison sentence for contempt of court or you know, making a false statement? What is that? But there were others, too. The prison was fully one-third pedophiles. And I don't mean just people who were caught looking at dirty pictures of children. I mean people we called touchers, people who had raped children, who had videotaped themselves raping children, people who had kidnapped children and had taken them across state lines for the purpose of raping them and filming them. There were murderers. Many murderers. There was a serial killer from Colorado that I wrote about. There was man from Pittsburgh who hired a hitman to murder his business partner so he could collect the life insurance money to pay a mafia debt. And indeed, we had a lot of members of the mafia, members of New York's five families. We had the boss of the Gambino crime family. We had the senior captain of the Bonanno crime family. We had De Cavalcantes and Brunos and Testas and Columbos and you know, very... This was a real prison. These were very dangerous people.
And so you did become friends with some of them. But how does it? Were people aware that you were CIA? And how do you figure that? You write the title of the book. What was the difference?
Well, my case was very high profile, and it was covered largely on the front page of the New York Times. So any literate prisoner in the prison knew I was coming. They knew the date I was going to be there. They knew I was coming to their prison. And there was one Italian from Philadelphia who, for whatever reason, from the kindness of his heart, took it upon himself in the week before I arrived to go to every single one of the Italians and explain to them the difference between an FBI agent, whom he described as a cop, and a CIA officer, whom he described as a patriot who's working overseas to protect the country. And so most of those Italians had no idea that that CIA officers didn't have arrest powers, didn't carry badges, weren't breaking down doors to arrest American citizens. They don't know any better. But he explained this to them, and as soon as I arrived, the Italians took me in.
And what was it like? I mean, segregation, prison really is exactly like the outside world, only, I suppose your chances of getting killed inside or outside are about equal these days. But that said, how does segregation work as the architecture of...
Yes. Prison is 1950s America. If you're African American, you only eat with other African Americans. The cafeteria is segregated, like I say, right out of the 1950s. The blacks are with blacks, the Hispanics with Hispanics, the whites with whites, and then in the very back of the cafeteria are the pedophiles and the rats, people who testified against co-defendants. They're shunned by everybody. But even in the TV room, there's a black side, and then there's a white and Hispanic side. And certainly, you know, you can sit on different sides of the room. People don't. I did, only because I had friends of all races, and I never had any problems. It's just this ingrained thing that people do because they've always done it that way.
And yeah, talking about it, I want to make sure that we have time for you to talk about the betrayal. There is a colossal betrayal which I did not see coming. imagine you didn't either.
No, I really didn't. And like I said in the book, I kick myself for allowing myself to put my guard down.
How did that happen? How do you figure this huge betrayal went down, I don't know.
What you're talking about is on my very first day in the prison, I saw a very tall, bald, thin man, kind of looking at me, and I was looking at him, and I was thinking, boy, I think I've met that guy at some point, somewhere. Finally, after lunch, he came up to me, and he said, are you the new guy from the CIA? And I said to him, did you serve in Pakistan in 2002? And he said, yes, I did. And he put his hand out, and we shook hands. And I remembered him. I was the chief of CIA counterterrorism operations in Pakistan after the 9/11 attacks. And I remembered this guy. And the reason I remembered him was because he was wearing a T-shirt, but with the big poofy Pakistani pants called shalwar kameez. And he was wearing a Yankees baseball cap. And I remember joking about him to one of my colleagues. And I said, who's the guy in the getup? And he said, oh, I don't know, he's one of ours. I think he just came in from the border. And that stuck in my mind, and I recognized him. So he said, listen, you're sitting at the wrong table. I didn't even realize on my first day in prison that the cafeteria was segregated like it was. And I was sitting on the African-American side. So he said, you can't sit here. I'm surprised they didn't tell you to get out. You have to sit with the white guys. And this was before I started sitting with the Italians every day. So we became friends. And not only did we become friends, but we became roommates. And we had similar interests. We would exercise together every day. We would eat together. We would talk constantly. We would talk a lot about the CIA and about some shared experiences. And about 6 weeks into my prison term, I started writing a blog series called Letters from Loretto, which constitute about half of this book. And this just confounded the prison administration. They repeatedly threatened me with solitary confinement because I kept writing this blog, and they wanted to know how I was getting it out. So what I would do is I would handwrite it, and I would make photocopies. I would send one copy to my attorney using the legal mail system, in which the prison is not allowed to open legal mail. I would send another copy directly to the website under the media mail system, and same thing there. If you're sending something to a reporter, the prison can't open it. I would send a copy to myself at home, to my wife, and then I would give this friend of mine, Dave, a copy because he was supposed to hide it with another prisoner somewhere in the prison. In the event that the cops did come and get me, I couldn't rat myself out and tell them where the hidden copy was. Well, to make a long story short, it turned out that Dave was a rat for the Special Investigative Service at the prison, and that's how they ended up knowing when I had a letter from Loretto coming out. That's how they knew what I was saying in advance. I just assumed that they were actually going into the legal mail or into the media mail. But Dave was a rat. And he wasn't just ratting on me. He was ratting on everybody we were coming into contact with. I was angrier, really, with myself than I was with him, because I promised myself before I even got to prison that I would not become close enough to anyone to trust them. But I let my guard down, and I did trust him, and he was the one who screwed me in the end.
How did he do that? What was the play there?
Well, I think for a long time the play was he was getting brownie points for himself with the prison authorities. He didn't have visitors, for example. And because he didn't have friends or family putting money into his account, I think, frankly, the cops were putting some money into his account, which they do. They do for their rats. They also give their rats books of stamps that the rats then use to gamble or to buy food at, we call them convenience stores. Mm-hmm. Prisoners run convenience stores out of their lockers at a 30% markup. So I think that's what he was getting. Now, he ended up becoming involved in a major, what became a violent dispute with a notorious pedophile, and he was taken to solitary confinement. Well, I learned from another prisoner later that he was offering to rat me out on something else. I mean, there was nothing else, but he was obviously thinking of making something up to get himself out of solitary. They didn't buy it, and he ended up being shipped to another prison in Elkton, Ohio.
And that was it. You never heard. That's a fairly, I would imagine, as these things go, fairly major betrayal. How did that change your various relationships? How did the power structure inside Loretto change with that conference? Did it make a difference?
He had actually run afoul of the Aryans, and I had correct relations with the Aryans. He continued to poke the hornet's nest. Whenever there was somebody he didn't like, he would do things like try to spread a rumor that they had a pedophilia arrest in their past. And these were other Aryans. And so finally the Aryans had had enough. When Dave was scooped up in this dispute with the pedophile, the Aryans, I learned later, went to the cops and said, if you let him back out into general population, we're going to kill him. And so the cops called me down, and they said, the only reason you're not in solitary is because we didn't see you on video going into the pedophile's room. I said, I didn't have anything to do with that pedophile. It was Dave who had the problem with the pedophile. I minded my own business. And he said, well, the Aryans said that they would kill him if we brought him back out into general population. And I said, I don't know anything about that. I don't know anything about the Aryans, and I don't care what you do with Dave.
And how you left it at that? Was there any...
I left it at that. You know, the cops were constantly calling me down to their office for a couple of reasons. One, when other prisoners hear this announcement, Kiriakou, lieutenant's office, rumors always begin that you've been called down to the lieutenant's office to rat on somebody. Well, that's a potential death sentence in prison if people think that you're a rat. So they called me down to the lieutenant's office, and they would say, hey, there was a fight in your unit last night. What do you know about that? And I would always say the same thing. There was a fight? I didn't know there was a fight. What, do you guys want me to do your jobs for you too now? Stop bothering me and wasting my time. And then I'd walk out. Well, they would call Dave down, and Dave would actually rat people out. And some of the people he ratted out were Aryans. And you can't live a peaceful life in prison when you're making an enemy of the Aryans.
Yeah, I would imagine that anyone who's ever been inside concurs with that. But you had rules from CIA training that you used. What were those rules?
I decided on my very first day, when I realized that I wasn't going to get into a minimum security camp, I decided to rely on my CIA training to ensure my safety and to ensure that I remained at the top of the social heap in prison. So there were these 20 rules that I had been taught in training at the CIA. Most of them were serious rules, things like recruit spies to steal secrets or anything else you need. Or if peace is not to your benefit, chaos is your friend. And there were some that were lighthearted. Admit nothing, deny everything, make counter-accusations, which I frankly used all the time. Another one was seek and utilize available cover. It was incredible to me, incredible, how a fight would break out and people would stand up to watch the fight. Well, my God, if you're standing there when the cops break the fight up, you're going to solitary with the people who were fighting until the investigators can sort out exactly what happened. Seek and utilize available cover. That means at the first sign of trouble, run back to your cell, pick up a copy of the New York Times, and pretend to read it. So when the cops say, what about that fight? You say, fight? What fight? What are you talking about? I don't know anything about any fight.
And then they come back and ransack the cell. Well,
repeatedly.
So what? What incident? Is there anything that's not in the book that you experienced that was really extraordinary?
Yeah, there was one thing. I kept it out, frankly, for my own safety and for the privacy of others, but I'll share it with your listeners. My brother told me when I was first assigned to FCI Loretto that there was a prisoner there who was the boss, the actual boss of the Gambino crime family. He was doing 18 years on 18 murders. Very, very dangerous man. My brother said, whatever you do, stay away from this guy. He's dangerous, he's violent, and the Italians have a very long arm. So I kept my distance. I had been there about 6 weeks, and I was sitting in my cell reading the Wall Street Journal, of all things. And one of his goons, one of his bodyguards, comes into my cell, just walks right in. It was a guy we used to call Stupid Tony. He had his eyes were crossed. He couldn't read. But he was an enormous guy, 6'5", 300 pounds, all muscle, just dumb as a sack of stones. So he walked in, and I looked at him, and he said, "Hey, the boss wants to see you." And I said, "He wants to see me?" And my heart began to race. So I follow Stupid Tony all the way down to the North Unit. And we walk into the boss's cell. And there's another prisoner clipping the boss's toenails, which was just utterly bizarre to me. And when he got up from having his toenails clipped, he brushed his teeth. And I'm standing in the doorway and watching all this. He brushed his teeth, and then when he spat all over the rim of the sink. And he punched the bunk bed to wake up another prisoner, and he says, "Hey, get up. Clean this up." And the guy jumps out of bed. "You got it, boss." And he cleans up all the spit from the sink. So I cleared my throat, and I said, "Excuse me." I used his name. "Did you want to see me?" He says, "Come in, sit down." So I walk in, I sit down, and there are half a dozen bodyguards in there just standing around, big, nasty, tough guys. And he says, "Are you the CIA guy?" I said, "I am." And he says, "You write a book?" And I said, "I did write a book in 2010, yes. Your book do good?" he says. I said, "Actually, it did very well. I made number 5 on the New York Times bestsellers list." And he nods, and he says, "You're going to write my book." And I said, "Oh, is that what this is about?" I said, "Okay, well, let's think about this for a minute." I said, "Frankly, most of the books in this genre are written by rats. And they spend the first half of the book talking about all the cool things they've done. And the second half of the book, they spend trying to justify why they became rats." And I said, "You're not a rat. And you probably shouldn't talk about all the cool things you've done." And he looks at me, penetrating stare. And he nods slowly, and he says, "Hadn't thought about that. Never mind." So I got up, and I walked out. But from that day on, I was invited to every Italian dinner and party and social function, and we watched the Super Bowl together, and I went to their New Year's Eve party with them, and they treated me like one of the guys. And that, I'm going to say, that was 50% of my safety for the whole time I was in prison.
Yeah. Regarding safety, and before we talk a little bit about, I want to get up to date on torture and torture under the Trump administration, which I suppose could be described as torture. Trump administration's torture, anyway. Any other people that you did time with that you would want to tell listeners about? Just so much of this, the book is like a play, and some of the characters stand out. The whole structure of it is Sophocles. It's an extraordinary book. But yeah, anyone else you want to mention? Before we move on and talk a little bit about torture under Trump.
You know, there's an old saying that you don't go to prison to make friends. And in fact, I made one friend who was so good to me that I stay in close touch with his family. Obviously, I can't have direct contact with him, as we're both felons. And I would violate the conditions of my probation and be sent back to prison. But I stay in close touch with his mother and his brother. He was the one that told the other Italians the difference between the FBI and the CIA. He became a true and good friend to me. And without him having been in prison, I'm not sure how I would have gotten through it. This is a guy who had never been in trouble a day in his life. But his stepfather talked him into helping the stepfather manufacture methamphetamine. And there were 9 people involved in the conspiracy. Mark was the only one who voluntarily left the conspiracy. He said, "Look, this meth manufacturing, this is not for me. I'm out." And he pulled out. And he actually opened a business that became very successful. It was a car repair shop. A year later, everybody in the conspiracy is arrested except Mark. And then another year after that, Mark is also arrested. So Mark was the only one who did not rat out his co-defendants. But he didn't know that the other co-defendants had agreed to rat him out. And at the same time, his attorney never told him that the government had made two offers of 10 years in prison in exchange for a guilty plea, and he wouldn't have to testify. So Mark went to trial. And of course, he was found guilty at trial because all nine of the other co-defendants testified against him. This is a first-time nonviolent offender and the only one to voluntarily leave the conspiracy. And he got triple life without parole. Triple life without parole. He twice attempted suicide. And then on appeal, his sentence was reduced to 30 years. But even still, 30 years, it's practically a death sentence.
They're all hard.
In 2014, the Justice Department launched this this program whereby people with inordinately long prison sentences related to the war on drugs could apply for a presidential commutation. And I was reading the article to him from the New York Times, and I said, "Buddy," I said, "you qualify for this." So we sat together for a period of about 3 weeks, and we wrote an appeal. You know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to write an appeal. You don't have to go to law school to write an appeal. You just do it as best you can, make sure your grammar is correct, and send it into the court. And so we wrote this appeal together. And I came home in February of 2015. In August of 2016, President Obama commuted his sentence, and he'll be home the 1st of October.
John, thank you. Hang on a minute. I just have to tell listeners that this, listening to KBOO Portland, I'm Chris Andre. My guest is John Kiriakou. He has written an extraordinary book. It is doing time like a spy, and it's everything that suggests and a lot more, and it takes you in directions that are entirely unexpected. So, though if you have read Letters from Loretto, if you stayed up with that, then parts of it are familiar. To continue on, now we're under, all of this happens under Obama, and now we're in the Trump administration, and though Trump has not turned his watery it's like rodent, snake-like eyes on the prison system yet, it probably doesn't make enough money, though he's got his henchmen working on that angle right now, I dare say. How prisons it's an American prison is unlike other prisons in the rest of the world. And in their cruelty and the humiliation, and the risk of death on a daily, moment by moment basis. But that said, Trump is likely to want to appear. It's all appearances in it. He's likely to want to appear tough on crime. He's said as much. And
That it just infuriates me when I hear things like that.
Yes.
But you're exactly right. The truth of the matter, though, is the United States has 5% of the world's population, and it has 25% of the world's prison population. The solution is to crime is not to lock up more and more and more people. It's to rehabilitate people. Now, our European allies have figured this out, and they've implemented this kind of a program successfully. But what we do is we just sentence people to longer and longer sentences. We send them to prisons where there's substandard health care. People die in prison all the time. Four people died unnecessarily while I was at Loretto, just in the short time I was at Loretto. And there's literally no rehabilitation. You know, time was when you could learn a skill in prison. You could learn electrical work or small engine repair or plumbing or anything, you know, how to type or how to use a computer. Now there's literally nothing that they teach you in prison. So if you are, let's say, a drug dealer and you get arrested, and years ago you would have gotten 2 years, now you get 10 years, you serve your 10 years in prison because there's no federal parole. If you get 10 years, you serve 10 years. You get out and you go back to your neighborhood and you're angry and unskilled and semi-literate, and the only thing you know how to do is to sell drugs. Well, what do you think you're going to do? You're going to sell drugs. And it creates this terrible cycle where people are constantly being sent back to prison. Recidivism rates are as high as they've ever been. And then we can't figure out why our prisons are overcrowded. It's because we're doing it wrong. And we need to take a lesson from our allies because they do it right.
And I gather from the book that social structures in prison lend themselves to exacerbating the program. For example, someone who was such as the fellow that you went down to north end of the prison to talk to, the Italian Grand Boss. So they would be able to, if they're doing a long jolt, then they would recruit others who were doing shorter ones and teach them and school them. I mean, prison is indeed a form of education. How does education, the only education available, work? Prison, because they could train someone to getting out and then them loose on the streets.
Right. The only formal education that there was in the so-called education department was pre-GED and GED classes. That was it. So if you already had a high school diploma, you were just out of luck. There was nothing else for you. But I did say in one of my letters to Loretto that I learned a lot when I was in prison. You know, I learned how to conduct mortgage fraud. I learned how to set up a Ponzi scheme. I learned how to manufacture methamphetamine, really good, high-quality methamphetamine. So, yeah, you're going to learn a lot from other prisoners in prison, but it's not the kind of thing that the government wants you to learn.
And it's the prisoners teaching. So what were some of the classes that prisoners were? Wasn't there physics, I believe?
There were prisoner-taught classes that were held in the library. I wrote about this as well. And some of them were just, it was just prisoners explaining their crimes. how to carry out a fraud operation, for example, and they learn from their own crimes, right? So they'll go into real depth about how they got caught, why they got caught, and how you can change it so that when you get out and you do it, you don't get caught.
Lessons learned, as the Army says.
And these were sanctioned classes. They were classes that were sanctioned by the Education Department and held in the library.
And again, something that tax dollars are paying for this. By the way, we're financing in incarceration university. I want to ask you too about another thing that the U.S. does that is less than admirable. We don't see ourselves the way we are seen by the rest of the world. The United States thinks that the rest of the world looks at us with awe and respect, and wow, what a great country! They're so powerful and so smart, and all this. It's become to the point where employers can't find people to do high, you know, technical jobs, and they need to have special visas to bring those people from overseas. But that's a other subject of torture. You being America's probably foremost or a preeminent whistleblower on the on torture, certainly the first person out of the gate, or the first person, first with the character and the strength and to be able to speak out, knowing you must have known what was likely to happen. And on the subject of torture and waterboarding, now Trump says that he wants to reinstate waterboarding, and he says worse. What's worse than waterboarding?
You know, in all honesty, I think that there were several different things that the CIA was doing that were worse than waterboarding. One was called the cold cell, where a prisoner was stripped naked and chained by the hands, by the wrists, to an eye bolt in the ceiling so that he could not sit or kneel or get into a comfortable position. His cell was chilled to 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and every hour a CIA officer would go into the cell and throw a bucket of ice water on him. We actually killed people using that technique. And another one was sleep deprivation. We know from the American Psychological Association and the American Psychiatric Association that people begin losing their minds around day 7 of sleep deprivation, and they
see that's happened to me. That's happening to me right now. It's Friday.
Well, they begin to die around day 9.
It's not funny.
But the CIA was authorized to keep people awake as long as 12 days. And we've got one defendant at Guantanamo who lost his mind from sleep deprivation and is unable to participate in his own defense. So, you know, we were doing things that I think were just so much worse than waterboarding. They are clearly illegal, violations of both U.S. and international law, and indeed crimes against humanity.
And they're still doing them, are they?
I don't know. I hope not. They say that they're not, and the congressional oversight committees haven't said anything one way or the other. President Obama said that he ended those practices formally with an executive order when he was first inaugurated. But here you've got not just a president of the United States, but a CIA director and an attorney general, all of whom have said that they want to reinstitute this program. And if you don't have members of Congress on the oversight committees with the guts to stand up and say no, then what's to stop them? Where's the oversight? There is no oversight.
And there's no one minding the store. We don't really know, and Trump probably assumes that they took him seriously when he said that he wanted to continue the program. I wonder why there aren't there hasn't been an outcry. I wonder why there are no whistleblowers. I mean, people have seen what happened to you. They can, anyone who wants to, well, in May when the book is officially out, can read the book and find out exactly day to day what is likely to happen to them. But still, one's conscience, I would hope, would prompt someone in one of these programs to speak up.
Say something.
And you wonder, too, if maybe they have, but they have been, I don't know what to say, silenced, or...
Right.
They may have been moved out of, so far out of... the chain of command is to be, or perhaps driven mad by some of these techniques. These can be turned on.
Well, I will say, though, that generals Mattis at Defense and Kelly at Homeland Security, now secretaries Mattis and Kelly, have come out against torture quite publicly and vocally. And I like to think that they are the adults in the room at the White House. And will stop this president from re-implementing a torture program, which, frankly, is so obviously illegal that it would wrap people right up in a criminal case.
Okay, then. So we can we'll hopefully be able to some of that comfort, but reassure ourselves that these things are not being done now on our watch, though other forms of what do we call it, misbehavior, certainly being in cahoots, as it were, with the likes of Netanyahu and Putin,
right.
And we're tending more and more in towards a populist autocratic state, as are other countries. We're watching the French election, and we're watching how Theresa May is managing Brexit, and wondering how this happened. I'm watching to goings on in Syria, and seeing that the U.S. was in there It brought them democracy, which gutted the nation. No schools, no education, no jobs, no nothing. And immediately ISIS and the likes of various forms of ISIS move in and to that vacuum. So we're leaving a similar vacuum in European states and in the U.S. where the education system has been gutted. So there are no jobs. The jobs are not coming back. They're gone. They're
right.
And in that vacuum that is being created, I think that if nothing else, the Trump administration's purpose is to create the type of vacuum in which leaders like him are able to function completely unrestrained. That's what I'm seeing, and I'm wondering from a CIA operative's perspective where the U.S. is right now in that spectrum. And this, by the way, is all the time that we have right now. If you have an answer to that, you feel...
Well, I think the CIA is in a transitional period right now. It's working for a president that it doesn't like or trust, and it's transitioning from a traditional spy organization where people recruited spies to steal secrets to a cyber security agency and a paramilitary agency, an agency whose job it is now to parachute into places and kill people. And I think that the administration and even the CIA's leadership has not really figured out how to do that and still operate within the confines of the law. I think that really what we need is another round of hearings like we had in the mid-1970s with the Church Committee to really get to the bottom of what it is that the CIA is doing in our names and to determine whether or not it's legal. And if it's not, it has to stop immediately.
So our judicial system now is somewhat contaminated, it would seem. But that said, we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
It's a real pleasure speaking with you again. The book is, wow, I'm telling you, you're really inside there. It's hard to read because it is claustrophobic and it takes you into that world. It's the book, of course, is Doing Time Like a Spy. We'll be speaking again, I hope, with John Kiriakou, my guest today, later on. Thank you so much. And this is Chris Andre for KBOO and News and Public Affairs. My guest has been John Kiriakou. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Time marches on. Time stands still. Time on my hands. Time to kill. Blood on my hands. My hands in the till, down at the 7-Eleven. Gentle rain falls on me. All life folds back into the sea. We contemplate eternity.
And that was KBOO's own Chris Andre speaking with John Kiriakou, CIA whistleblower. I think the only person to do time over the illegal CIA torture of illegally held prisoners in an illegal prison camp outside of the United States. And he was just the one who reported the crime. Apparently, that's a crime now. What's not a crime is your support of KBOO Community Radio, and thank you, KBOO members, for that support. For those of you who have not yet become members of the KBOO Foundation, that's still not a crime as well. But you can make yourself innocent of any potential charges at kboo.fm/give. We're about to hand it over to Moving On this week with your host, the one and only, the inimitable, and what a gal, Lori Sonnenfeld. That's all coming up right after these important announcements, so stay tuned to KBOO Portland, your community radio.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, April 21st, 2017. In France last night, on the last day before a national election, a shootout took place on the Champs-Élysées. A lone gunman opened fire on police, killing one and wounding two others, as well as wounding a bystander. The gunman was killed while running away. Since a major attack in 2015, 10,000 French soldiers have been deployed across the country to, quote, keep the peace. Those soldiers have been accused of profiling immigrants and people of color. The militia group Daesh, known in English by the acronym ISIS, claimed credit for last night's attack.